2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 152, The Rise of LDS Psychotherapy, a paper presented by Eric G. Sweden, with a response by Jake Zollinger.
We're about ready to begin session number 152, The Rise of LDS Psychotherapy. Our speakers today are Eric Sweden and Jake Zollinger. Eric Sweden is an assistant professor at Weber State University. He actually has a PhD in history, but he's a professor of information systems and technologies. He tells me that his expertise is in stopping hackers. So, quite interesting there. He has a book that's available in the book room that you may have seen. It's entitled Healing Souls, Psychotherapy in the Latter-day Saint Community. He lives in South Weber, has a wife and four children, and we're very glad to have him with us today. Our second speaker, who will be responding to Eric Sweden's paper, is Jake Zollinger. Jake is a longtime Sunstone supporter, volunteer, enthusiast. He's been coming to Sunstone ever since its inception, as may some of you. He's a school psychologist and a family and marriage counselor in Davis County, and he has an interest in theology, which combination there of his psychology background and his interest in theology makes him an excellent responder today. Just a few notes, and then I'll turn the time over to Professor Sweden. First of all, admission, of course, is by ticket only. If you don't have a ticket, please be sure to get one and give it to the greeter at the door there. Please turn off all cell phones, pagers, and other noisemakers. After Professor Sweden and Jake Zollinger speak to us today, there will be a roughly 15-minute question and answer period. When you ask your question, please come to the front and ask it into the microphone so that it's on the tape recording. Let's see here. Also, when you ask your questions, please make sure that they're concise and to the point. We're here to listen to our speakers and not each other, hopefully. And I guess that's about it. With that, I'll turn the time over to Professor Sweden.
Okay, thank you. That was a good introduction. This is not normally how I speak into a microphone. When I teach class, I'm used to walking back and forth in front of the class. Sometimes my students have commented I'm like a metronome. But in this case, you just get me in a stationary position. I thought maybe I'd start off by how I came to this topic. I am not a psychologist. I was in graduate school at Case Western Reserve University. And I went back there wanting to study the history of technology. And for various reasons that didn't work out, and I started looking for another topic, and psychology, which had always interested me, started to draw my attention. Because my father was a social worker. And so even though I was not trained in psychology, I grew up imbued in my conversations with my father with the entire psychological point of view and psychological way of thinking about things. And came back to Utah, and I was going to do a history of the state mental hospital down in Provo, whereupon I found that they had very limited records that were available for me to look at. And as I was looking around, I discovered this organization I'd never heard of called AMCAP, which stands for the Association of Mormon Counselors and Psychotherapists. And I started to look into that, and I found that there was a really interesting story there. And that resulted in a dissertation, which later resulted in this book, which was published last year by the University of Illinois Press. The book is called Healing Souls, Psychotherapy in the Latter-day Saint Community. And the phrase healing souls comes from a talk that one of the general authorities gave to one of their conventions early in their career. But before I want to go into further, I want to talk just a little about psychotherapy, which is the practice of using the principles of modern psychology in trying to heal problems that people have or make them more so they can more effectively live their life. And I would say that psychotherapy is an art that is informed by science, in the sense that I think studies have shown pretty conclusively that it is the personal attributes that the therapist brings to this, to their interaction with the client or the patient, that really helps or hinders whether or not healing takes place. And those personal characteristics are true empathy, unconditional love. A lot of, quite frankly, what we can think of is the Christian values and what are often values in other religious traditions around the world. So what we find is even today, empathy and skill is more important than the therapy mode or the theory that comes in behind it. In fact, most therapists today are in fact what we call eclectics. They pick and choose from different therapy modalities when based on what's best for their patient. And what's ironic from a philosophical or theological or especially philosophical standpoint is the therapies that they choose, that they may be using one type of therapy in the morning and their type of therapy in the afternoon, may not be compatible philosophically in any way, in the sense that they may not make the same assumptions about human behavior. They may not make the same assumptions about what are the best outcomes, what is the best way to live a life. So I need to, and the reason for that is why it's more of an art than a science, is because people are hard to study. When psychologists stand up or psychiatrists stand up and say, we are scientists, they're making a claim that they want to have the prestige that's associated with science, like in the physics or astronomy or chemistry, where you have physical phenomenon that's easy to repeat. And quite frankly, human behavior is not that easy to get to be easy to repeat and easy to be completely amenable to what we think of as traditional ways of studying, of scientific study. But that doesn't mean that you can't be rigorous in your study and that you can't approach it scientifically. And there is some really good science going on in the psychological field. So I don't want to imply that it's just all made up, whatever you want to believe, because it doesn't have to be that way by any means. Anyway, let's move on and talk about AMCAP. AMCAP, again the Association of Mormon Counselors and Psychotherapists, was founded in 1975. And it was founded by and large because if you look at the LDS community, they had been very insulated in the Utah core region during the late 19th century and early 20th century. But after World War II, psychology, the modern psychologies, became really popular. And one of the first places they made heavy inroads in was in school counseling and schools, and basically providing therapy through not only therapy but school testing and other services to the newly expanding college system that emerged in this country after World War II. And what happened is you had a lot of people leaving Utah, going to other places, getting trained as psychologists, coming back, wanting to engage in therapy, and you had, quite frankly, a religious community that was somewhat hostile to it. If you want to, a good example of that is, if you go and look in Bruce R. McConkie's book, Mormon Doctrine, 1966, under psychiatry it says, see Church of the Devil. Okay. Now, there's no doubt that, especially at that by that period of time and earlier, psychiatry was very associated in the public mind with Freudian psychoanalysis. And Freudian psychoanalysis was pretty hostile to the religious point of view. But even within the church, you had this newly emerged group of, when I say, I'm going to say psychotherapists and therapists, because they didn't all come from psychology. Some of them came from social work, some came from psychiatry. They came from the different places that are grouped as and called the helping professions. And so one of the reasons they founded ANPCAP, there were earlier organizations. There was an organization called the LDS Personal Guidance Association. There were some other really small organizations in other mental health fields. And they all came together and said, okay, we're going to found a larger organization, and we're going to try to... The real purpose was gain acceptance of psychotherapy in the LDS community. And they understood the place to really gain that acceptance was that to gain acceptance among the general authorities. So AMCAP, which meets twice a year, they meet conference weekend, the Thursday and Friday just before conference in Salt Lake City. Every convention except for one, to my knowledge, has always had its headline speaker as a general authority, so they've always invited a general authority to come speak. And because they wanted to create, it's not an officially sanctioned church organization by any means, but they wanted to maintain strong links because they wanted to increase the acceptance of the modern psychologies within the LDS church. And of course, not only did they, AMCAP initially faced three large challenges. One was gaining acceptance. The other one was the issue of homosexuality. And the third was feminism. Now, this is the mid-70s, and both of those issues, while still very current today, were very, very prominent at that time. Because in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association had been lobbied extensively by pro-gay rights groups and had removed homosexuality from its list of pathologies. So up until 1973, if you looked at a book that was published by the American Psychiatric Association, what you would see was homosexuality defined as pathology. After that, that was no longer the case. And also feminism, with the Equal Rights Amendment movement, with the women's movement, which has been revived in the early 60s, again, feminism was a big issue, and I'll come back to those in a little while. But not only was AMCAP interesting to me, what else was interesting was something called the Institute for Studies in Values and Human Behavior. And this was an institute that was founded at BYU in 1977. Did I get that right? Or did I miss? Okay. Sometimes such a long title, sometimes I mix it up. And what happened with that is this was nothing less than an institutional attempt to create a gospel-oriented theory of psychology. And one of the key players in this was a man by the name of Alan E. Bergen. Alan E. Bergen is probably the most prominent LDS psychologist, period. He just retired a couple of years ago. And what's interesting is, and I'll go a little into his career, Alan E. Bergen was not born a Latter-day Saint. He converted to Mormonism while in college. He met his future wife at Reed College. She was LDS. She decided to go to BYU. He followed her to BYU and converted, and then they married. And he went on to... can't remember where he went on to get his doctorate. Columbia? Well, that's where he went. Stanford's where he went to get his doctorate. And then he went to Columbia Teachers College, where he gained an international reputation as a psychologist. He and a man by the name of Sol Garfield published the Handbook of Psychotherapy. I hate to use that title. No, that's not... I cannot remember the name of the book, but basically this is one of the top textbooks for the last 35 years in psychology departments around the country. And where he started to make his name was in doing research in what was called outcomes. And outcomes is this idea, okay, we've treated people. Did it make them better? Did it make them worse? and he engaged in research that effectively showed that oftentimes they weren't any better, and sometimes they were actually worse. What's kind of interesting about it is it's very similar to something that happened in the history of medicine. In the history of medicine, in the early 19th century, there were some studies done at a French hospital. And what this study did is they used the new science of statistics and showed that going to a hospital was actually more dangerous to your health than staying away from the hospital. And there's a reason for that. Back then, that it was prior to understanding the nature of germs. It was prior to understanding, so they didn't understand disease vectors. It was before you had anesthesia. So surgery was literally a physical assault on your body with nothing to numb you except maybe some alcohol. And if you had any money, you didn't go to the hospital, because hospitals were where soldiers went and where the poor went. So it was basically a poorhouse. And now, what happened is medicine made technological and scientific advances and overcame that early problem with the fact that they were killing people. Well, what outcome studies showed was if you actually followed people, you didn't always have positive outcomes. In fact, oftentimes you didn't have good outcomes at all, and there was no, statistically, you couldn't show that going to a therapist was a better chance than just staying on your own. Now, the important thing is, and later on, as outcome studies became more sophisticated, they found that, well, the type of therapist, who that therapist is, makes a big difference. And to a smaller degree, what type of therapy they want to use makes a difference also. So he became very prominent for this, and later was hired away to return to BYU. And at BYU, you saw during the 70s a lot of efforts to try to apply the theological precepts of Mormonism to different fields of study. There was a psychological association founded that published for a short time a journal trying to apply Mormonism to sociology. Did I say psychological before? Sociology. You have the founding of interests in anthropology and archaeology within the LDS context. And then you have this idea that, well, they had a disconnect in their professional lives or an incongruity in the fact that here it is, as Latter-day Saints, they believe certain things about human behavior. But then they go to graduate school and they're taught other things about human behavior that are conflicting. How do they reconcile these together? And some people, a lot of people say, well, you don't really reconcile them. One's a matter of faith and the other one's a matter of science. Well, what Alan E. Bergen and the other people at the Institute want to do is say, no, we want to integrate these two together. And this was not an effort that was confined just to Mormonism. This effort also existed in other churches. The mainline Protestant churches had all engaged much earlier in integration efforts between the modern psychologies and their theological beliefs. In fact, what you find, if you look at it, is the mainstream Protestant churches, by and large, I would say, surrender is probably too harsh of a term. They did integrate, and what they did is they found more truth in their psychological tradition and psychology than they did in their religious traditions, and had a tendency to strongly integrate that. Evangelical churches did not do that. The Catholic Church, it varied on the different experiences. There were different experiences. Some they incorporated more so, other ones they didn't. In fact, as a good example of this is if you go back to the late 19th century and you were a Presbyterian or a Methodist and you went to a theological school, to a seminary in order to be trained as a pastor, you would have received a lot of instruction on reading the scriptures, the religious traditions of your time. By the middle of the 20th century, if you'd gone to those seminaries, not only would you have received theological training, you would have received an enormous amount of psychology training. And in fact, you would have graduated qualified to be a psychotherapist in addition to being a pastor. So they combined these two roles together. And what you have there is the what was formerly called the cure of souls, now is heavily informed by modern psychology. You didn't see that happening in the LDS Church. And one of the reasons for that is the LDS Church effectively has no theological seminaries. The LDS Church is run by lay leadership. So you're not going to have some training mechanism to train bishops and state presidents on how to counsel, from a psychological standpoint, the people in the ward and their stake. So, coming back to the Institute for Studies and Values in Human Behavior. It was very ambitious. Alan E. Bergen served as its first director. And they immediately went to trying to construct some theories. And the theory group formed by the Institute had such luminaries as Truman Madsen, C. Terry Warner, and other prominent psychologists and philosophers at BYU. And they did some interesting things. In 1980, they had a large conference held at BYU, in which was basically a conference on values in psychology. And Alan B. Bergen got up there and said, basically, the theistic values, the idea that belief in God, the idea of belief in God and that revelations come from God, were perfectly valid values and should not be rejected out of hand by the psychological community. And this is very controversial, because studies have consistently shown that people that go into psychology and into psychiatry as a profession are less religious than any other profession in the country, and except for philosophers. Philosophers consistently rank below that too. So what happened is, and he went on a crusade. Alan E. Bergen went on a crusade. And he talked at conferences all over the country and all over the world, arguing that room should be made for a theistic point of view. And furthermore, psychologists should be open to the fact that their religious clients have values that they may not agree with, and that those values should be honored in the context of the psychological session. And in fact, this is a continuation of the humanistic strand of psychology. This is a continuation of what's called client-centered therapy, which Carl Rogers had promoted. Client-centered therapy is the idea that the client heals themselves, that the client brings their values in, and that it's not your role as a psychologist to try to change their values unless those values are completely maladaptive, and then you might encourage them towards changing them. Very different than, say, going back to some of the psychoanalytical traditions, for instance, Freud. I mean, Freud, you go in and you're going through psychoanalysis, and they're going to be telling you, and I am very much simplifying this, they're going to be telling you the flaws in your thinking, the way that you should be thinking. Whereas you don't see that in the client-centered mode of therapy so much. So, this institute is kind of interesting. It only lasts for 5 years. Okay. And the institute is disbanded. And it continues in the sense that one of the things that's created is the BYU Comprehensive Clinic, which is a training mechanism and a place for therapy for students who are... It's a training mechanism for graduate students at BYU, and it's also a place for therapy for... They see actual patients or clients, and they also work closely with LDS Social Services in order to create training material. Now, that's what, to me, was interesting is... Out of AMCAP and out of the Institute, you see in the 80s and 90s lots of training material being created for LDS Social Services. You see training material created for... you see training material created for bishops and state presidents. You see one-day seminars being offered. You see books being published. And what I see happening is you see the the psychologization, boy, I'm having a tough time with that one today, of the LDS community. In the sense that 30 years ago, if you were listening from the pulpit in General Conference, would you hear the general authorities using psychological terms? No. Today, is it uncommon? It's not. Especially if you're really attuned to this, it's not uncommon for them to talk about things like self-esteem or other types of, or using other terms that came from psychology. What's happened, though, and this is my contention, is that the LDS Church has integrated with modern psychologies to a limited degree. And what they've done is they've always integrated to the extent that they felt comfortable, and that if it conflicted with core church teachings, those core church teachings were not reinterpreted. Those core church teachings were kept intact, and psychological thinking on those grounds was pushed back. The best example I have of how psychology has changed thinking within the traditional LDS community is with regards to suicide. If you go back 100 years and you read theological thinking or even the common thinking on suicide in the LDS community, it's going to be not only is this a crime against the person, it's a crime against God. In fact, if you commit suicide, you have no chance of exaltation. You have no chance of even the terrestrial kingdom. You hear stories of, you know, people that commit suicide were buried in black. In fact, I remember being told one story in southern Utah of a person, she committed suicide, and they buried her in black, upside down, with her feet going the wrong direction. Now, is that a strong message there? Today, the stance on suicide is completely different. Today, you see from church teachings from conference, you see it from books that are being published, the attitude is, we don't know why people commit suicide. We cannot judge why a person commits suicide. And there is no theological or ecclesiastical restrictions on them. A person who commits suicide can be buried in their temple clothes. They can be buried. The church ceremonies are performed. It's a total 180 degree change from what we believed in the 19th century. And I would argue that comes from the fact that psychology and understanding, what psychology does is it helps understand not only the potential of humans, but also the limitations of humans. And we understand that people who commit suicide, you know, are in so much pain that they can't make rational, moral choices. Another thing you see is, if you look at all the books that are being published, in the 70s you had a few books published. In the 80s and 90s you've had an enormous number of books published by Deseret Book, Bookcraft, and other LDS publishers about how to use their self-help books. There's how to go and engage in psychotherapy, how to find a therapist, how you can apply therapy to your own life. And what I found was interesting is you have a psychologist that take their research that's for the larger psychological community, and then they publish in that community, and then they turn around and take that research and they put it in a context with the LDS community, and they publish something in the LDS community. A good example is there's a book that was published about 10 years ago called Spirituality and Self-Esteem by a couple of professors down at BYU. And there was no one that wasn't at BYU. But what happened is that came from a psychological study on self-esteem that's well-regarded. It resulted in a book that was published by the American Psychological Association. And then they turned around and say, okay, we're going to apply it to a completely LDS context. And they talked about, where does self-esteem come from? And they argued that, in their case, they argued that self-esteem does not come from where we normally think it comes from. Self-esteem does not come from achievement. Self-esteem comes from inside people deciding whether or not they like themselves and whether or not they have the self-confidence and they value themselves. And they, because what they found is there's not a correlation between self-esteem and achievement. And then they turned around and said, okay, now we're going to talk about it in the LDS context about spirituality. How do you increase your spirituality? And what's interesting is they recognize that they don't have all the answers, in the sense that the book basically argues that you cannot be a deeply spiritual person if you don't have self-esteem. But it never actually says that explicitly, because there may be examples that don't exist. Plus, quite frankly, I'm sure that there were people that read that that feel they have really poor self-esteem, and the last message they need is, you can't be spiritual. Because, I mean, that's another way of battering down their self-esteem. And there's other books. Carl Fried Broderick wrote well-regarded books on marriage and family counseling for the non-LDS community, and then turned around and wrote that same type of book for an LDS context, looking and using LDS values. Another thing that the LDS Church has done is it's rejected what's called selfist psychology. Now, selfist psychology is a term that was popularized by a psychiatrist turned Christian, Paul Vitz, in the late 70s. And he argued that selfist psychology is the preoccupation with the individual rather than the individual's roles and responsibilities within the community. And, you know, his critique makes a lot of sense. You look at psychology, especially further back in the 60s and 70s, it was all about how can you, a significant part of it was about how can you as an individual break free of the restrictions of your community and find self-realization. And what I argued was that the LDS Church rejects selfish psychology. One of the great quotes from Ezra Taft Benson was, "Salvation is a family affair." I hope I got that right. In the sense that you cannot go to exaltation, you cannot be saved in the LDS context in that way, without your family, without fulfilling your obligations to your family, and it's not individualistic in that sense. Some of the other controversial issues, sexuality was always very controversial, homosexuality was always very controversial, the topics of women and depression. In the late 70s, that was a very common topic. There was multiple articles being written on Mormon women and depression, and there was a strong perception that Mormon women were more depressed than non-Mormon women. And in some of the articles, I'm thinking of an article by a psychiatrist by the name of Burgoyne, basically argued that, of course, when Mormon women are depressed, they're Mormon. But and then you had other studies that were a little more clinical and a little more used statistics, and what they found was Mormon women are not more depressed than non-Mormon women. If you do a large enough sample, so you get a good statistical sample. And now what you do find is, to some degree, a greater abuse of prescription drugs, greater use of antidepressants among the LDS community than the non-LDS community. But by and large, the reason for that is the antidepressant of choice in our country is alcohol. And because they weren't allowed access to that antidepressant, they're more inclined to use prescription antidepressants like Xanax or Prozac or Valium. Okay. Some of the other things that are interesting, the issue of demonic possession. I talk about that to a degree. The reason for that is, especially people who have been on missions or in church sacrament meetings, every once in a while you have this idea of demonic possession come up, and the idea that someone's behaving in a way that they shouldn't behave because an evil spirit's possessed them. Now, That's a pretty controversial issue for psychologists, because that's the old way of thinking about human behavior. And that's always been something that LDS psychologists have always kept at arm's length. And but there was a case that was actually published as a case study of an LDS psychologist who felt he had encountered that and had used the power of the priesthood to overcome that in his patient. And it's interesting. What's interesting to me is when you have people that were behaving in a very odd manner, a good example that I found and I discussed in the book is Idaho, 1920s, near Twin Falls. No, Idaho Falls. There was a convert to the church that was behaving extremely bizarrely. And they attributed it to demonic possession. And they had regular exorcisms. Now, the Catholic Church has a very defined theology around exorcisms. The LDS Church has a set of anecdotes that sort of vaguely define the parameters of that. But there's no exorcism prayer. There's no set theology of who's been possessed, who hasn't been possessed, how do you solve it. But repeatedly they cast out the demons through priesthood prayers and priesthood blessings. And what's interesting, reading the accounts, is she also received an operation. And that's all they said. I have no idea. I could never find out what kind of operation she received. But the fact that she had received an operation did not invalidate, for the purposes of faith, of the people that were interacting with her. It was just one other step. And they considered her to be a solved problem. So today, by and large, if someone came in and said they were experiencing demonic possession, I would venture to say most bishops and stake presidents would send them to LDS Social Services. Okay. I need to wrap it up really quick, they say. And LDS Social Services, I didn't talk that much about them. They're an interesting resource that is what the church has done. When LDS Social Services was created in the early 70s, it was initially created for the purposes of enabling adoptions. And as they started to provide more psychological services, the church authorities looked at it and said, this is a never-ending black hole of money. I mean, they probably didn't say it that way, but that's what they were thinking. If we provide this cheaply to all members, there was no way we'll ever be able to afford to keep up this. So what they did is they pulled back. And they said, okay, we're going to provide advice to LDS, to bishops, and state presidents. We're going to work on selected cases. We're going to provide training material, and we're going to provide referrals to private practitioners who agree with LDS values. And I guess I should wrap it up, and hopefully we'll continue in the question phase.
I will spend a few minutes responding to Eric's interesting talk, about 8 or 9 minutes at most, hoping that my brief prepared remarks complement approximately his subject matter. I had only the paragraph in the schedule to go on, as he did not submit a paper for my perusal. I did, however, read his fine book, so I knew in a general way of his material. Eric's book filled a niche in the Mormon literature that will round out and give continuity to our knowledge of Mormonism's relation to psychology. The history is not a long timeline and parallels the rise of psychotherapies in the United States. I'm not an historian nor an academic, just a humble practitioner. There may well be other shrinks who could comment more intelligently than I. Neither do I think of myself as particularly old. However, the history Eric has reviewed has nearly all occurred in my adult lifetime. I have lived in it, through it, and around it. 40 years ago this fall, I took my first psychology courses at Utah State. To my knowledge, there were only a couple of counseling psychologists in all of Cache Valley, and they at the university. No clinical psychs, no psychiatrists. As I recall, and my information may be faulty, there was one psychiatrist in Ogden during the late 50s, early 60s. He was resorting to frontal lobotomies en masse and was pressured out of town by the medical community. I do not know how many psychiatrists, clinical psychologists, or counseling psychologists were in Salt Lake at the time, but I rather suspect they were clustered around the U. There were four psychiatrists at the state hospital and a new clinical psych department at BYU. Gradually, as Eric recounts, the Mormons have assimilated psychotherapeutic practice over the past 50 years. It has been a fragile relationship, and why should it not be? After all, as Eric said, Freud represented most of psychotherapy to that point in time, and he was atheistic. Mormon Doctrine was the most popular book consulted by Mormons after 1958, and psychiatry was cross-referenced to Church of the Devil, implying that anything not comporting with the church standards was from the evil one. When I returned from the New England mission in 1967, my good bishop asked me what I intended to do. I said, become a psychologist. He gravely replied, I thought the church opposed that. This was actually quite a frequent response, either in the form of a question or a comment. I sometimes felt almost disloyal and very, very liberal for a farmer's son. I felt more secure at BYU, where I knew the psych professors were all good, sanitized Mormons under the watchful eye of Ernie Wilkinson. Things went swimmingly for me until I was a senior in that Disneyland of wholesome, beautiful girls and family home evenings. I met a girl from my apartment complex whom I began to date. She was 29 years old and not a student. She was very sexy, a fact which occasioned much dissonance with my testimony. When she found out I was a psych major, she asked if I knew Professor So-and-so. I said yes, he was my teacher. I asked how she knew of him, not being a student. She balked. It's not important, she said. I persisted, and finally she confessed that she worked for him. As a secretary, I asked? No. What then? Well, she said, I'm kind of a model. What do you mean? She replied, I help with the homosexuals. I was shocked into disbelief. I never suspected there could be a homosexual at BYU. I only read about that in textbooks. She described to me how she dressed in a skimpy negligee and caressed the professor's clients, speaking provocatively in a soft voice in a darkened room. She was introduced to the homosexual client, coinciding with the removal of electronic shock or some other aversive stimulus. She was in this way associated with the removal of pain and hopefully would, after some time, elicit a pleasant response from the client, reversing his arousal to the same sex. After a sleepless night, I asked several psychology majors if they had ever heard of such an abomination. All responses were negative. Only at BYU could something this timely in the world of behavioral psychology be happening and yet be isolated from the professor's own students. By the way, he was doing that therapy off campus in his private clinic. So, these brief anecdotes are intended to portray the state of Mormonism versus the healing arts circa 1960-1970. On the list of Mormon forbiddens, psychology was somewhere between miniskirts and communism. It is understandable that the general authorities of that time would be slow to accept the flowering of new psychotherapies coming on the scene. Mormonism, once innovative and radical, has been slow to accommodate most new social trends during the 20th century. Moreover, psychotherapy could be seen as a substitute for repentance, good home teachers, priesthood healings, and plain old pioneer fortitude. We should not be too critical of Spencer Kimball and Marky Peterson, for example, for advising homosexuals to repent, get married, and their feelings would become normalized. Such was the state of the art. Only in the past 30 years have such bizarre disorders like autism and schizophrenia been understood as bioneurological in origin. When I was a budding psychologist, these and other debilitating conditions were thought. I dropped my membership in AMCAP early on, and I was gone from BYU before Allen Bergen and his associates tried to develop a unique kind of Mormon therapy. I do not believe a unified theory of psychology is practical, if even possible, because of the great variation in human character and in the many maladies that arise in human beings. I do believe that it makes sense to involve a person's religion and relationship to God in therapy. Where I work in a state institution, the school system, it is normal procedure to keep religion and public ed separated. I have no colleagues who mix the two. I, however, have often given my adult clients a choice as to whether we should integrate their religion into therapeutic goals. Not long ago, I had in my caseload a 10-year-old boy who moved here from Ohio with his mother, who was young, irresponsible, and negligent of his needs. He had no involvement with a father who had long ago rejected him, no uncles, aunts, cousins, or grandparents within reach. He had no scoutmaster, no church leader, nor baseball coach. His only island of normalcy in life was 6 hours a day at school. He was discouraged, worried, and very insecure. After about 3 sessions, I felt helpless to improve his condition. I said right there in a public school building, "You know, Morgan, you have another father who is strong and powerful and loves you very much. He won't abandon you, and you can talk to him." He had never been told of God nor led in prayer. So I taught him my Mormon version of God and how to pray. After getting permission from a client, I am not afraid to include God, the commandments, and church policy in therapy. In discussing how therapy is conducted with Mormons, Eric notes that most shrinks are eclectic in their approach. I agree. In person, most psychologists will tell you they use cognitive behavioral therapy, they use Rogerian, Skinnerian, or Love and Logic. In reality, I believe they all just wing it. Eric also reasons that Mormons today have come of age and pretty much have assimilated modern psychology as harmless and even helpful. I agree there has been good progress, but I still sense a hesitancy for Mormons to seek therapy without misgivings. After all, if a family is living right and has the gospel advantages, why would they need psychotherapy? Isn't our religion all about coping and enduring and having the answers? I still see parents who are afraid to deal with ADHD and learning disabilities, let alone admit to a troubled marriage. If psychology has given us anything of value, surely it is the understanding of psychiatric disorders and some pretty fair treatments for the same. Much benefit has come from the recognition and treatment of autism, Asperger's syndrome, ADD, Tourette syndrome, schizophrenia, depression, bipolar disorder, and so on. Mormons need to be aware that these problems are equally distributed across socioeconomic lines and are a part of life whether one actively lives the gospel or not. On the other hand, some people are over-psychologized. I do not believe a person needs to see a professional for dealing with the normal ebb and flow of life. Close human relationships are invaluable in weathering the vicissitudes of life. Mormons, above all people, have opportunities to cultivate closeness with family, friends, and church associates. Freud used the term alter ego, literally other self, to describe closeness of two individuals who are attuned to one another, whether a college roommate, a neighbor, or even a parent. One blessing in life is to know that someone else experiences your pain, your joy, and values your life with the same total concern as his or her own. To serve this function, one must represent to the other an authority or worthiness born of respect for that person's integrity, strength, and morality. Someone qualifying as your alter ego has the tacit power to calm you in trying times. Total trust and full self-disclosure with acceptance is a means of permission for you to heal. I believe effective counselors are more born than trained. A study at a university assigned troubled students to counselors in 3 groups. One group were licensed practicing professionals with experience. The second group were psychology students, and the third group were English majors. After the prescribed number of sessions, the troubled students rated as a group the English majors as most helpful counselors. Some people are natural healers, and they come from all walks of life. Eric deals with the issue of homosexuality in his book as it concerns the church and psychologists. The general membership is oblivious to the plight of the gay Mormons. I will not, in the interest of time, examine this issue here, except to say there is no consensus among Mormon therapists about how to work with homosexuals. While mainstream experts feel this orientation is inborn and unchosen, the general authorities still refer gays to the minority practitioners who see homosexuality as a learned disorientation. This may prove to be the hottest point of contention in the new century. Finally, I would like to say that LDS eternalism as a theory of human origin should give Mormon social scientists a leg up. Believing as we do that mankind was sired and begotten in a divine process that is imitated by us mortals adds a dimension of status not imagined by other theorists. If anything should prompt or encourage a unique Mormon psychology, it must be the doctrine that men and women have a continuity of consciousness on both sides of mortality. I have pondered why some people who are born into wonderful LDS homes with nurturant parents and happy childhoods in the church become dull, passive, disinterested Mormons, even turning their backs on the faith. Others who are called resilient by researchers overcome every obstacle to productive adulthood and convert to the church. These choice people defy all the odds of poverty, abuse, broken homes, transiency, alcoholism, crime, and so on, to become new spiritual creatures as adults. We have all wondered if the preexistence as a conditioning time is the answer to this mystery. That men and women are of the lineage of gods is certainly an idea that should affect the way we see our clients and each other. I believe the Mormons will continue to take the good psychology has to offer in the future, because understanding ourselves as human beings puts us in better touch with our own eternal natures. Explorations in human psychology should be viewed as a positive and worthy pursuit in our quest for a good life. Eric Sweden has outlined for us the history of Mormonism's interface with psychology's rise in America. I heartily recommend this excellent book. Thank you.
Looks like we've got about 7 or 8 minutes for questions and answers. If you want to come to the microphone, that's fine. If you'd rather just stand up, I'll repeat the question into the microphone, and we can go from there.
Yeah, I was just wondering, Eric, do you have statistics on Utah suicides and how they rank in the nation? What studies are being done?
Question is on Utah suicide statistics and what's being done about it.
Well, I don't have the suicide statistics off the top of my head, but in general, the Rocky Mountain region for some reason has the highest suicide rates in the country, though Utah within the Rocky Mountain region has the lowest rates. But because it is the lowest in that group, it is higher than in the rest of the country.
About 10 years ago, Dr. Chuck Hunt at the university was aware of those statistics and looked into them somewhat and found out that the suicide rate among young men between 18 to 24 in Utah was the highest in the nation. And he started some graduate students on a project to interview the families of suicidal young men. And we left Utah at that time, and I haven't heard what the outcome of that was. But at one time, I was talking to him about something else, and he said his house had been broken into while they were on vacation, and everything he had been removed from his computer. And he was wondering how something like that could happen, or even why anyone would be interested in what he had on his computer. But he wondered if it had something to do with some of the studies he was having graduate students do. And I would just like to comment.
I'm not familiar with that. So there's ongoing studies on suicide, but I'm not familiar with any of the results of that. Other than, yes, and then you go ahead.
Eric, I don't know if you're aware, but you mentioned the 1966 version of Bruce R. McConkie's book, right. Mormon Doctrine. Well, if you go back to the 1958 version, he said, well, in some instances psychology can help, but in most instances it's a form of apostate religion. And whereas the psychologists try and bring your values down to your good values down to your bad behavior, we in Mormonism bring your bad behavior up to your great, you know, good ideals, which of course is an oversimplification. I don't know if you're aware of that. And then in the very conservative Mormon ward that I grew up in, I was always told, well, if you're living the gospel, you don't need a psychiatrist. You've probably heard that a million times too. And I found out the hard way that that was a total abominable falsehood. I think my life would have been a lot better today if there had been a more favorable climate.
Yes, I agree. Just to add an anecdote, I had a friend who read my book in manuscript, and he described me, it was very interesting because he described me that he had strong same-sex urges. And he went and saw a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist was non-LDS, and the psychiatrist's reaction to him is, I don't see what your problem is, go out and get laid. And that's exactly what he told him. And that was not compatible with his belief system, and he didn't go to anyone else. And so he's sort of a lost soul out there. And that is a particularly difficult issue, there's no doubt about it. Yes?
I had two questions about ethics, but that was kind of
okay.
One of them. So I'll just ask the other one. I have been told that when somebody agrees to do work for LDS Family Services, there's a number of things they have to agree to, one of which is that if they're counseling a couple, they will not counsel them to divorce. Another is, I've been told that they have to agree that the counselor can share information with their bishop. And I'm just wondering, that was
right.
The understanding that a friend of mine who used to do work for LDS Family Services and quit because of that.
Right.
And I'd like to know if that's
That's interesting. I'm not sure on those two cases. I do know that if they do share information with the bishop, they do say up front, this is what we're going to do. And I do know that the LDS Social Services has created a program specifically for families in which incest is a problem. And they say explicitly at the front, you will not be able to participate in this program unless you are willing to participate with the civil authorities in following up on criminal actions. So again, I don't know on those two specific cases. I've talked to different people in the LDS Social Services. They never mentioned that, but that's very possible. That's very possible. Yes, you in the back?
Yeah, I was just part answer. I've actually never heard that as a therapist. However, specifically on substance use, when missionaries along to their way, I was shocked at the level of material they had. They pulled out a lot of the people from there. They had charts that thick. And one of the arguments we had was they thought everything should be released to the mission project. And I argued the opposite, that you should get advice whether a person should go or not, but leave it at that. I don't know what the results was that, but that one experience shocked me, even as a therapist, that they have so much medical information on these people.
Yeah.
Well, I assume that the therapist had releases. And my guess is that the missionaries were told that they had to get a release.
We've got time for about one more question.
Yes.
Do you think it's just a matter of time before the Elders Church offers premarital counseling and or classes for engaged couples?
I think that on an informal practice that already happens. I know when I got on an informal practice that already happens. I know when I got engaged, we went and talked to the bishop. And now this was, 19 years ago. But I think that you already see that in an institute. One of the most popular classes in an institute is in fact a premarital class.
Okay.
Excuse me. The BYU Department of Marriage and Family Counseling, I can't remember the professor's name, but they're developing a and emphasizing that very thing right now. Assessments and counseling for premarital couples.
Other churches require before they'll marry you within their
I can see them requiring a bishop's interview, because effectively you already do require it. But I don't see it, they're never, I don't see them going and sending you to a psychological professional.
The training
for the bishops? I can see a pamphlet being created, because that's how most training for bishops happens, is pamphlets. Yeah, that's true. Okay.
Thanks very much for attending. That concludes the session. Please keep in mind that cassette recordings of the session will be available out of the Sunstone desk in about half an hour or so.
And if anyone's interested, there's flyers on the book up front.